hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open to the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument in the April term is Mudland versus Hills Materials Company and Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. For the appellants, Hills Mutual Materials, we have Gregory Strowman, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, Mudland, we have William Jason Groves, an attorney from Rapid City. Mr. Strowman, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Greg Strowman. I'm from Rapid City, and I represent the appellants, Hills Materials, and Liberty Mutual. Vanessa Mudland was injured in a traffic accident that did not occur or arise out of and in the course of her employment. She did not give timely notice and proper notice of her workers' compensation claim, and she was guilty of willful misconduct, which would bar her claim. The facts are fairly simple. On June 7, 1999, she was supposed to report to work at Faith, South Dakota. Hills had a road construction project near Faith. She lived in Rapid City. That was her home base. Work commenced at 7:30 a.m. on Monday morning, June 7th. The night before, she had stayed up till 1 a.m., actually on the morning of the 7th, got up at 4:30 to get ready to go to work, so had only about 3.5 hours of sleep. She had also, the night before, taken some Valium, which is a barbiturate for back pain. It was a prescription she had left over. When she awoke and got ready for work, she went to the quarry in Rapid City, which is a place where employees sometimes met to either carpool up to Faith or to ride in a company vehicle. When she went there that day at 5:30, there was no one there, so she started to drive to Faith, which is what she did most of the time anyway, was drive her personal vehicle.
You say sometimes met there. I thought there was kind of a company policy that they were all supposed to go there and then go to the work site so that they could like give somebody a ride if somebody else didn't have a ride, or they could ride in a company vehicle.
That was available to them, Your Honor, but it wasn't required or mandated that they go to the quarry. She could have come from Aberdeen or Pier or someplace else, as long as she got to the work site at Faith, South Dakota, 7:30 a.m. Monday morning. That's when she went on the clock.
Isn't showing up at the quarry kind of like reporting in?
No, because they don't report in until they get to Faith. That's when the foreman writes down on the time cards who's at work, whether they're there on time, and that's when they start their work day. The quarry is simply a place where if they want to, they can catch a ride either in a company vehicle or carpool or drive themselves.
Would your view of the case be different if the only difference was that she was in a company vehicle, that she had been driving a company vehicle instead of her own vehicle that day?
If she had been driving a company vehicle, she would have been compensated and she would have been working at that point, Your Honor, because the policy says that they're paid while they're driving a company vehicle. Not if they're riding in a company vehicle, but if they're transporting a company vehicle to the job site, then they're paid.
But they also get the mileage allowance for their personal vehicle.
Yes, they do.
So what's the difference whether she's driving her car or a company car?
Well, this was just a benefit that she had when she would, if she's driving a company car, she's taking that up there as part of her work. I mean, they need that vehicle at the scene, whether it's a pilot car or some other piece of equipment. But when she's driving her own vehicle, it's not used in the job up there at Faith.
But you say a passenger would not be considered to be in the scope of employment at that time?
No.
A passenger in a company vehicle?
That's correct, according to the policy, Your Honor.
What if he's helping to navigate how to get there?
I guess I don't have an answer for that one. I guess you could extend it that far if you wanted, but there's cases where I guess that canal case talks about someone who's asleep in a vehicle, but that wasn't a workers' comp case. I don't think that gets to the point where they're actually doing work for the employer if they're just riding along. work actually, you know, if you're transporting a company vehicle to the job site, then you're working for the employer. That's kind of what was going on in that Martin Beach case, that Pickrell case. That was a company-provided vehicle, and the expense was borne by the company, and he was entitled to compensation when he was returning home from work at the end of the work week. One of the things that's significant in this case is Mudlin never actually got to work that day. And there's cases in South Dakota, the Dreesen case specifically, Your Honor, where actually the employee had been at work and had completed his work day, was actually taking the team of horses, an instrumentality that was actually used at work, taking it home, and they still found that he was not entitled to compensation because of the going and coming rule, where we do not provide compensation for going to or coming from work. And he was not subject to a risk inherent to the occupation. It was simply being on the highway, which is exactly what Ms. Mudlin was doing in this case. She wasn't doing anything particular to her employment. Now, the test for workers' compensation is whether the injury arose out of and in the course of employment. And arising out of means that the accident had its origin in the hazard to which the employment exposed the employee while doing her work. In this case, driving to work on a public highway in a private vehicle does not fit that definition. It doesn't arise out of her employment. In the course of employment refers to time, place, and circumstances of the accident. And in this case, the time did not include her work. She didn't start work until 7:30 a.m. That's when she went on the clock. The time that she was traveling was not reported as towards her overtime. It wasn't, there was no taxes taken away from that. It was just a per diem and a travel allowance. The place of the accident, again, she was not at the work site. She was on a public highway miles from the work site. So that's not in the course of employment. And the circumstances are not in the course of employment because she was not doing road construction duties when she was just driving to work like anyone else drives to work. In Norton, the court denied compensation even though she had a closer connection to work than Mudlin did. At least in Norton, that particular employee had commenced work and completed work to some extent that day by taking the kids to the ski trip, and she was captive as to time and place, whereas Ms. Mudlin was not captive. She could have gone any direction, any way she wanted to, but she, according to the testimony of the Hills safety manager, she was paid for what they believe was 2 hours of driving and taking the first half hour out as the policy called for. And I think that the reason that the first half hour wasn't included is because generally, people in South Dakota probably 15 minutes, 20 minutes to drive to work, sometimes 10 minutes, sometimes a half an hour, depending on where you live. That really isn't anything that you need to give a travel allowance for. But, you know, when Hills, out of its desire to make a benefit for its employees, went ahead and make this payment, they should not be held to be the insurer for everything that happens going to and from work. Workers' compensation insurance is not designed to be that type of accident insurance or all-encompassing insurance, and they don't assume that burden by doing that.
You know, if this was truly not work-related, and when I say work-related, I mean the two tests, but why would they compensate him anything? Why would they give him even the $9?
Well, again, they gave him a per diem of $8 per day, plus they gave him the travel allowance one way, but they do that as an accommodation or a benefit to their employees, not to say that you're working at that time. It's a different rate than their pay scale when they're actually on the job. It's not included. There's no FICA taken out of it. There's no unemployment taken out of it. There's no it doesn't count towards their 40 hours a week and towards overtime. It's just a benefit that they give them. It's not intended to pay for all of their travel expenses because it's such a nominal amount. And the other thing is that it goes to people who don't drive, who are just passengers in private vehicles. So there you have, they don't have any particular expenses, but it's still an accommodation or a benefit that they give them. But under the case law, which I think is well-reasoned, it has to be a substantial payment where the employer pays all or substantially all of the expenses. Just like in the Pickrell case, the South Dakota case. But in those cases from other jurisdictions, it's almost uniform that it has to be a substantial payment of all or substantially all of the travel expenses in order for it to fall under compensation. The Roberts versus Stell case talks about workers' compensation not being intended to be health, accident, and old age insurance, and spread protection over risks common to all and not arising out of in the course of employment. In this case, she simply wasn't doing her job as a road construction laborer. I mean, she didn't actually, in order to be fall under the ambit of compensation, she didn't actually have to have a shovel in her hand, but she did at least need to be at the work site and working to be covered by workers' compensation. It's generally taken for granted in Larson and the general rule in South Dakota is that workers' compensation was not intended to protect against all the perils of the journey between home and factory. And in this case, that she was just going from home to work. She may have been coming from somewhere else, but they calculated the approximate time that it would take to go from her home base in Rapid City to Faith, and that's what they based the payment on, and it's $9 because it's about a two-hour drive. So she chose to, the mere fact that she chose to endure the commute and to use her own vehicle, just in no means that she was doing anything that she was employed to do at the time of her injury. And that's when workers' compensation comes into effect, when you're doing something that you're employed to do. It arises out of the employment or in the course of your employment. You're doing something inherent or unique to your employment, not just being on the highway and traveling to work. Everyone does that, and there has to be some place where you draw the line. It has to be a substantial payment. She could say that, you know, I got up in the morning and took a shower to get ready to go to work, but, you know, because that was, you know, part of my duties was to get cleaned up and get ready to go. And if she fell in the shower, then could she claim workers' compensation for that? Or if she fell out of bed the night before when she was resting up for work, where do you draw the line? There has to be some rule, some hard and fast rule. And in this case, the rules are, as stated in these other jurisdictions, that it has to be a substantial payment, and it has to be work, an activity that arose out of and in the course of employment, not just going to or coming from work. And the court has reiterated in the Howell case that we don't take, even when they found compensation in that case, we don't take away from the going and coming rule. And in Howell, the person had been at work all day, and she was still on the workers or on the employer's premises when she fell and was injured. And that was something inherent in her employment. She had to leave the premises. In this case, Mudlin never even got to the premises where she was supposed to work. And in the Lang case, that person didn't have a fixed place to work and didn't have a fixed time and place when he was injured. So the court found compensation there. But certainly injuries that are suffered.
There's a similarity here, because here the work site is always changing, isn't it? As the road work develops, it moves. Isn't that a little different from the routine commute that the going and coming rule generally covers?
Well, the job site may move a few miles or it may move to another place, but you're still commuting. And if it's a half hour from her home base, then she isn't given anything. But it's still a remote area where she goes to work.
Do the cases that you citing to us talk about these long distance commutes to a moving job site? Do you have cases that support that position that you're taking here?
I don't know if those specifically talk about that situation, Your Honor. I do know that they're uniform in that they say it has to be a substantial payment in order for it to fall under compensation. Whether the facts of each of those cases talk about that, I can't say.
Before you run out of time, address how the special mission exception might apply in this case.
Well, she wasn't on a special mission because she was just going to work. The special mission would be if she is doing something in furtherance of her employer's work and it still would have to arise out of and in the course of her employment. She was just trying to get to the job site. She wasn't doing anything that her specifically was, you know, asked for her to do. And it didn't do anything in furtherance of her work when she simply was commuting to work.
But the policy the custom was to meet at the quarry, and then the policy was employees are expected to furnish personal transportation. If I read that right.
Well, it says travel can be by either company furnished or private vehicle and will be treated as it states in the policy. And it says in here, and this is something that's been, I think, misconstrued, it says the method of transportation is a decision made by the supervisor of the specific cruise. In this case, the testimony is uncontradicted that they were able to go however and wherever they wanted to go, whichever route they wanted to go. They weren't required to go to the quarry. I think what that means is that, you know, if the supervisor says, I need a pilot car out there, we're going to take a pilot car, he directs that. But as far as getting the employees to the job site, they're pretty much left to their own. I mean, the company will accommodate them. If they get there at 5:30 and there's room in one of the company vehicles, they can ride along if they want. Or it's up to them. They can take their own vehicle. But that was the testimony that was uncontradicted by all of the Mr. Pacheco, the supervisor, and also by Mr. Johnson, the safety administrator. The second issue is that she failed to prove that she gave timely and proper notice. Now, obviously, Hills had actual notice of the accident, but they did not have actual notice that she contended that it was work-related until well after the time for giving notice. She did spend several days in the hospital, and when she did confront or did bring it up to the attention of her supervisor at Hills, she said, that, you know, is this covered by workers' comp? He said no. She didn't challenge that. There was no indication to Hills material that this was a work-related injury, and therefore they didn't have an opportunity to investigate the injury or the accident to any degree.
But isn't the purpose of that requirement to effectively put the employer on notice so that they can do the investigation that's necessary to determine whether it's work-related? That's the whole reason for the notice.
Certainly, Your Honor, but every time an employer can't be required to, every time someone says, you know, my back hurts, or I don't feel well, and you know they're at work and they don't say, well, is it from work or not? I think it's unrealistic to require them to conduct an investigation every time. Certainly the purpose of the statute, the notice statute, is to give them that opportunity. But in reality, unless they have some indication that it's work-related and that she was going to contend that it was, they lost their opportunity to investigate the claim.
Well, they didn't lose their opportunity. They just didn't use what they had.
They didn't take the opportunity
okay. In
those circumstances, Your Honor.
Okay.
Finally, Mudlin's claim is barred by her willful misconduct. She testified that she had ingested Valium the night before the accident, which is a barbiturate and a depressant, that she stayed up until 1 a.m., got up at 4:30 a.m., knew she was going to be tired. She stopped in Newell for some caffeine to try to stay awake. She fell asleep at the wheel. The Highway Patrol report indicates she was going 75 in a 65 mile an hour zone. And she was not wearing a seatbelt. At least that's the conclusion. Her injuries were consistent with ejection. She was found 30 feet from the accident, from the vehicle. And although each of those things may just be negligence in and of themselves, when you take them together, it can be found to be willful misconduct when someone falls asleep while driving and knows or has reason to know that it's probable that they will fall asleep. South Dakota provides no compensation when an injury or death is due to employees' willful misconduct. And all these circumstances together can certainly constitute reckless disregard of the probable consequences of driving under the conditions she was driving.
But where do you get the reckless? You know, I assume she was under doctor orders to take the Valium. That's a non-prescription drug. Is that?
No, I believe it was a leftover prescription she had from years ago, is what her testimony was. It wasn't specifically prescribed recently to the accident. She said she had back pain. She had some leftover volume, and she took it.
But you're saying these three things are maybe, each one might be negligence in themselves, but where do you get the, where do you get the recklessness of it?
Well, and it may not be reckless, Your Honor, but at least willful or wanton misconduct. And in that Lukens case, the court found that proof that a driver was drowsy prior to an accident in combination with other factors was evidence of willful and wanton misconduct. I don't know that it meets the definition of reckless, but willful or wanton misconduct, which is what the statute bars recovery for, I think it, the totality of the circumstances brings it within that. And based on the applicable law and the evidence in this case, we'd ask that the court reverse the circuit court and the Department of Labor and remand with directions that the claim be dismissed.
Thank you, Mr. Stroman. Mr. Groves, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Please, the court. I'm here on behalf of Vanessa Mudlin as a result of an injury that clearly occurred during the course and scope of her employment. This is an important case. I'm going to cite you to Professor Larson's very beginning of the treatise, where he contrasts compensation with tort liability. Professor Larson says the right to compensation benefits depends on one simple test. Was there a work-connected injury? He goes on and explains, negligence and for the most part fault are not an issue and cannot affect the result. Let the employer's conduct be flawless in its perfection. Let the employee's be abysmal in its clumsiness, rashness, and ineptitude. If the accident arises out of and in the course of employment, the employee receives the award. Professor Larson goes on and says, the test is not the relationship of an individual's personal quality, and by that he means rashness or fault, to an event, but the relationship of an event to an employment. The essence of applying the test is not a matter of assessing blame, but marking out boundaries. This case is an important case, as these basic premises, as expressed by Professor Larson, are being directly challenged by Hills. The facts of this case are not largely in dispute. I can't find anything that's really actually in dispute. Although there are facts that aren't acknowledged by the employer, and I've attempted to point those out in my brief. Vanessa Mudlin's accident occurred while traveling from her base location, her recognized base location that's acknowledged in the employer's travel policy memo. Her base location is at Rapid City, and she's traveling to the actual work site at Faith. This case, as such, is one of first impression in South Dakota, as none of the past decisions of this court have been presented with a written travel policy establishing, first, the use of a private vehicle as an expected means of travel to a remote work site.
But for this policy, are you conceding that she would not be entitled to coverage?
No.
Then it's just a piece of the puzzle.
It's a part of the puzzle.
All right.
And secondly, the rate, there's a rate of actual pay established, $6 an hour. Now, you can divide it out by miles traveled. You can come up with a cents per mile. There's another way of looking at it. She's being compensated for her time. the employees traveling with her in her car, if there would have been someone at the plant when she stopped in the morning, would have received $6 an hour. That's in excess of the minimum wage.
No.
They're not required.
No, Mr. Strowman says that a passenger would receive nothing.
Well, the passengers in the company vehicle receive nothing. If the travel policy covers both company vehicles and private vehicles. If there's a passenger in the private vehicle, he gets $6 an hour.
So he would get more than she would have got for driving.
Well, they get paid the same amount for the commute. If you want to say it's X cents per mile, you can
do that.
Do they
not get paid for the first 30 miles?
That's right.
Okay.
That's
right. They're paid at the same rate that...
Same rate. And the thing, why is the employer doing this? You know, this is not generosity. I haven't met an employer that gives money away in this state in doing this work for nearly 30 years. They don't do it. It's not good business practice. So what is the purpose? The travel policy, they want to assure that you have a skilled workforce at a remote job site. If you want to find a purpose, there's the purpose. You're paying these people at an hourly rate, excess of the minimum wage, to get to the job site before the work that they're hired to do begins the day, the work day. But that doesn't mean that travel under the employer's travel policy is not within the course and scope of her employment. This court
does
has...
Does it matter? Go ahead.
How does that logic then, if you carry that further then, the difference between not being compensated if you're not being hourly compensated if you're in the company vehicle, as opposed to being hourly compensated if you're in your own vehicle or someone else's private vehicle? How does that fit in your logic?
Well, my logic would say that if you're traveling to a remote work site and the employer has a travel policy to get you there, you're in the course and scope of your employment. That's what my logic says. This case is not a difficult case in my judgment.
But in one hand, they're compensated for that time, and the other hand, they are not.
It's a dichotomy. I mean, I don't understand how the employer is, what they're doing. I don't understand. I can't rationalize the distinction here. You know, there's another part of that. I was going to get to that later, but I'll jump to it now. Got rhetorical questions someplace.
Before you do,
okay.
Does it matter that this is denominated or this is considered to be travel expenses to the driver and additional compensation to, say, a passenger, had there been one?
I don't think it matters a bit.
Does it matter under the cases?
I don't see that it matters. I don't see how it matters. You know, when you look at the cases, there are cases that say, well, it's got to be a substantial payment. But then it talks about the sheer size of the journey in the same breath. You know, in South Dakota, you're lucky if you live in a locality where you can travel for 15 or 20 minutes and get to a job site. And I imagine if you lived up in Spearfish, for example, 45 minutes from Rapid City, and you commute every day, that's part of your normal commute. You're not in the course and scope of your employment that I can see. But when you are being transported in the employer, at least in this case, and I got to remember to keep addressing the facts, in this case, has a travel policy to send their employees to remote areas and actually provides a means of compensation to them. I just don't see how that isn't critical, and it just doesn't answer the question about course and scope. You know, there, like I said, I had some questions about this very issue. And it kind of got to be whether she was willful or not, but if the guy that's driving the company vehicle is being paid his regular wage, and he has an accident, and the policy says these other employees can ride in the car with him, are they in the course and scope of their employment? Are they entitled to workers' compensation when the driver of the company vehicle has an accident? Certainly. Hills doesn't want to admit that. What about the people that are riding in a private vehicle with Ms. Mudlin if she had passengers, and they're injured? And they're going to get $6 an hour after the first half hour. Are they in the course and scope of their employment? You know, logic would seem, the law isn't always logical in my mind, but in this particular case, the logic would seem to indicate they are too in the course and scope of their employment. Because they're doing something that's naturally and probably arises from the employment relationship. There is no reason for Vanessa Mudlin to be headed in the direction of Faith from Newell after she stops and gets a Coke, except to go to the job site. She's serving the employer's purpose. She's meeting the requirements of the company policy. She is acting under an express direction by the company to resolve the issues of travel and how travel will be handled company-wide. These facts are not, Hills doesn't want to acknowledge these facts. These facts are critical to this analysis.
You acknowledge, though, that there was no policy, no written company policy that required them to go to the quarry first.
I would agree. There's no written policy.
So is it a custom, or what do you call it?
I think it's a custom. And reason, and it fits in the company policy. The company policy encourages encourages the conduct they want. They want carpooling is encouraged, as is sharing the cost with the vehicle driver. Hills doesn't want to acknowledge that anybody's required to go to the quarry. Going to the quarry is to pick up people that need a ride going to the remote work site.
So, Art, following up on that then, if she would have had the accident prior to the time she got to the quarry, or the first half hour or whatever, would she be covered still?
Well, that's kind of what I call splitting hairs, and that's I think I would say that yes, she is in the course and scope of her employment because she's going to a remote work site. In that situation, in the situation we have here, if she's going to the quarry to find someone to see if they need a ride to the remote work site, yes, I would find that in the course and scope. But that's not the facts I got here. Maybe that's another day. Now,
you repeatedly refer to course and scope.
Pardon?
You repeatedly, in your argument, talk about course and scope. Is that what this case is, as opposed to an arising out of case? Or are they both implicated?
I know the court has distinguished them. There's a way to distinguish them, and maybe I should. But I think they are so close in this particular fact situation. When I looked at those issues in my brief, when you're talking about, I think it is arising. Is it arise out of her employment? I think it does arise out of her employment. Is there something that's natural and probable? Yes, I think it fits And so I think that it's both a rising, and I think it's a course case. I think she's clearly doing part of her duties for which she's compensated.
So you say the employer cannot set the time when the workforce begins. They can't say it starts at 8. They can't say it starts at 8:30. But if they require, say, everybody to be there at 1:45 for a warm-up period or something to avoid injury, you say they can't do that.
Well, no, I'm only addressing this case.
You're saying they can do it, but then they're in the course of employment.
If there's something the employer is requiring, then that's something the employer, if he's not paying for, it's part of the job obligations, something that the employer demands as part of the job. And I don't know if that answers your question, but it seems to me if I'm an employer and I require someone to be at a job site by such and such time, that I require them to do certain activities to prepare for the day, I think that brings them within the course and scope. In this particular case, all those facts aren't before us. What we have is a travel policy. I haven't found in all the cases I've looked at a written travel policy by an employer compensating minimum wage for transportation to a remote work site. It just seems to me that it should be clear. Now, I am concerned here that I'm running out of time, though. This next issue is also very important, and it's concerning this actual knowledge and the reporting. There is no question under our statute, when there's actual knowledge, as here, she doesn't have to make a report. But there are other reporting requirements, other statutory requirements that I cite in my brief under 62.6 that are absolutely critical to making the compensation system work on time. Justice Sabers, when I was here years ago, said this is quite the way to run a railroad when we got cases that are 6 and 8 years old coming before you for final resolution or to be sent back for more facts. In my judgment, 62.62, 62.63 is critical to making the compensation system in this state run on time and making it easier on everybody. Now, the employer has said, she's not in the course and scope, so I don't have to make a 62.6 report. They obviate the requirement of a statute. They obviate the decision-making of the insurer to state the reasons why, if they're going to deny, all the reasons why they take a denial. And so you get these cases that are years old coming before you, and everybody is jostling facts that they don't know, that could have been resolved. Insurers have to make decisions timely about denial, why they're denying, in the absence of fraud. Now, turning lastly to this misconduct. I cite Cavender, and I rely on Cavender heavily. It's the employer's burden to show that the conducts are not rash conducts, as Professor Larson would describe them. That they're not due to ineptitude. They're not blunders. They're not clumsiness. And I think that's all you have here. You have someone, you may call her rash, you may call her negligent, you may call her inept. But she's not willful, wanton. There's no evidence that she knew this was the probable consequence. She took reasonable steps she knew she was drowsy. She stopped. She tried to take a break, and then she believed she could proceed. She did, and she went to sleep. The drive was long. It was foggy, according to her, at the time she had the accident. And it happens. Now, I think Cavender reaches at least the issues of seatbelt. It reaches the issue of drugs. And what's the other one I got?
Speeding,
thank you. It reaches at least those three issues. There is no evidence that the misbehavior, the misconduct, has either caused the accident or made the injury worse. This is a question, as this court has concluded, is a question for expert testimony. There is no expert testimony within the standards required of a reasonable medical or scientific certainty that the injuries she suffered are worse or were made worse because of the alleged misconduct. Lastly, this issue of sleeping. I've already talked about it in passing, and last night I'm always fearful I'm going to forget something or I'm
going
to miss
something. Your time has expired.
Pardon?
Your time has expired. Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Stroman, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I'd like to respond to the Chief Justice's question to Mr. Groves, because I believe, but for the fact that this travel policy was in effect, we wouldn't be here. The fact that Hills Materials decided to do something for its employees to help them out for having to go to a remote job site is what's putting them in this situation right now. They certainly didn't provide this type of allowance, this travel allowance, so that they could assume workers' compensation coverage for every employee that they have traveling to every job site throughout Western South Dakota or Wyoming or wherever they go. It was simply something that Hills did as an accommodation, as a benefit to their employees, and it certainly did not have anything to do with the test in this case, and in every workers' compensation case in South Dakota, is did the injury arise out of and in the course of employment. And the court has talked about these tests to be compensable. A claimant's injury must arise out of a risk inherent to employment. So is driving to work a risk inherent to employment? No. She's not doing something in furtherance of her employer's job, her work. It's a risk that's common to all to drive to employment, to drive to the job site. The phrase arising out of expresses a factor of contribution. She's not contributing to the work product when she's driving to work. She hasn't even started to work yet. She's not on the clock. She's not being paid to work yet. Her hourly rate is different. She goes on the clock when she checks in with the employer at the job site at 7:30 a.m. And she can't manipulate the work hours by going different times. Work starts when the employer says work starts. And the other thing is in the course of employment refers again to time. Well, what time did this accident happen? It didn't happen when she was on the clock at work. The place, it didn't happen at the work site. It happened on a public highway where everyone that travels to work is going to be, whether it's on a city street or a highway or wherever. And the circumstances under which the accident took place. She's a laborer, a road construction laborer, and a flagger. She wasn't doing that when this happened. And even if she was at work, that doesn't necessarily mean that she's entitled to compensation, because this court has rejected that notion that merely because an injury occurs while one is at work, that the injury arose out of and in the course of employment. The mere fact that an injury occurs on an employer's premises is not enough. In this case, Mudlin didn't even get to the job site. She still doesn't, she doesn't make any connection with work other than that she was traveling to work. Injuries suffered then that were not at work and not on the premises can't be said to be in the course of employment, and they're not compensable. The other thing is she's not paid at the same rate. That's another thing, that her hourly rate for working, for doing her job, is different than this travel situation. I don't think we have to rationalize distinctions about whether they were in the employer's vehicle or whether they were riding or driving or what they were doing, because the question is whether it arose out of in the course of employment. There are dozens of cases in South Dakota that tell us how to analyze the facts and how to apply those principles, the statutory requirement that it arose out of in the course of employment. The case law is very clear as to how we go about parsing the facts and applying them to this template of the law and the requirements of the law. And in this case, there can be but one conclusion, and that is that her injury did not arise out of and in the course of employment. And for that reason, the court should reverse the decision of the circuit court, reverse the Department of Labor, and enter its order dismissing this claim.
One last thing. Are you suggesting that the policy, travel policy, and the custom, I guess, of meeting at the quarry had no benefit to the employer, or no, you know, there was no advantage or no benefit to the employer for that? I mean, that it was strictly a gratuity, that they just wanted to be nice.
Well, I don't see any evidence that it's something. I think the evidence was that we wanted to take care of our employees. I don't recall any evidence in the record, Your Honor, that says that we want to do this because we're assured of getting a workforce there or anything like that. Granted, it may be difficult to get a crew in Faith, South Dakota, and they have crews in Rapid City that have worked for them for years, like Ms. Mudlin did, and I guess to some extent that's a benefit to the employer, but it doesn't make the travel something that arises out of in the course of employment. They weren't hired to travel to the job site. They're supposed to get themselves to the job site. That's just common sense. They're hired to do road construction work, and if she's injured doing road construction work, she'd be covered by workers' compensation.
But aren't they supposed to show up at the quarry to take anybody else to the job site in their own personal vehicle if they happen to be there?
It's not required. They can do that. I mean, again, we're talking about using common sense.
Custom. What do you say about that?
I think it's common sense that if you can pool your resources and go along, great. I don't think that that's something that makes this a work duty. It's not a work function.
But that is a benefit to the employer to have another employee, say, who doesn't have a ride to the workforce, to the job site, to be given a ride by a private passenger, by a driver.
Sure, and it is a benefit to them, and they actually compensate them even if they're just a passenger. That's true. But again, the rules that we see in these other jurisdictions that have decided this say it has to be a substantial payment in order, where they cover all or almost all of the travel expenses. And the fact that they pay people who are just riding along shows that it's not intended to be to cover all of the travel expenses.
Is there any reimbursement or travel expenses for the return trip back?
None, Your Honor. They have the daily per diem for the meals and so forth, but not this travel allowance. There's two separate things. It's computed on a separate timesheet from her wages. It's paid by a separate check from her wages. The travel allowance and the per diem are just a flat rate, nothing deducted from it, and it's totally separate from her payroll check.
So it's a little more clear if the accident happened on the way home that work would have stopped at 5 or 6 or whatever the time frame was, and that she was then no longer in the course of or scope of employment?
Well, under the going to and coming from, that's why we have the going to and coming from rule. We're not covered under either of those situations. But yeah, it would be clearer in that situation, Your Honor. But that's the whole point of the rule, is either going to or coming from, you're not covered. Whether there's a travel policy or something like that that provides some minimal, insubstantial payment really doesn't matter. What matters is did it arise out of and in the course of employment? And in this case, it certainly did not.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Strowman. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.